Welcome to the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. It's Monday, May the 10th, 1999. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1028 at this time. And before you begin, Senator, we just received hot off the press the Dash 4. I did open a public hearing, didn't I? Okay. Thanks so much.
Oh, you can have a public hearing.
Problem. Tell us about what the Dash 4 actually has in it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it breaks down basically into 15 sections, which I'll run through for you. Section 1 is a finding statement, and that is literally Section 1. The next part is Section 3, which is direct State Fire Marshal's office to maximize Internet access to its databases. Section 4 implements an affirmative reporting duty for people to inform the State Fire Marshal's office that they possess the threshold amounts of hazardous substances or above. Section 6 and 7 remove existing exemptions for pesticide recording and requiring pesticide applicator and operator licensing for specified public agencies. Section 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, ending at 14 are portions of Senate Bill 933 that require posting at schools and parks as well as child care facilities when pesticides or hazardous substances have been applied. Section 15 and 15, 16, and 17 are a pesticide study conducted by the by Oregon State University. I'm trying to find the right department here. Something has been. Section 18 is a water quality testing program to be conducted by Department of Agriculture and Department of Environmental Quality. Section 19 is directs the Department of Agriculture to implement an urban pesticide use education program. Section 20 directs Department of Agriculture and DEQ to coordinate their research activities. Section 21 directs Department of Environmental Quality with some input from the Health Division to identify waters that may have toxic chemicals in them based on the presence of aquatic life that has been exposed to symptoms or signs of exposure to toxic or hazardous substances. And it also directs the Department of Environmental Quality to prohibit the use of those identified waters from use as new drinking water sources until the DEQ certifies that they're no longer hazardous. Section 22 directs Department of Environmental Quality to implement a public pollution complaint program. Section 23 requires the State Department of Forestry to record and make available to the public any hazardous substances used on lands they own or manage. Section 24 requires a joint Department of Ag and Department of Environmental Quality report to the legislature biannually based on their water testing program in Section 18. Section 25 is the follow-up to the pesticide study, and that clarifies that the study will be carried out by the Department of Environmental and Molecular Toxicology based on fees and other revenues from pesticide registration. And then finally, Section 27 is the emergency clause.
Then we're here.
Senator Wild.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Wild. I'm a state senator, and I represent District 8. This has been a long haul for us. As you recall, Mr. Chairman, we met back during the interim, and we started putting together the ideas for how not only we would deal with keeping records of toxic substances, but also what we could do about it to help clean up these situations where they've already occurred. And you came with me to tour part of my district, and we looked at the Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard site that now has become a Superfund site that DEQ did a drive-by, and they identified it as a potentially hazardous site, but in fact, their response to us when we asked why didn't you do anything about it was that they said there were 60 or 70 such sites in my district alone, and this was did not rank high on their list. And so, quite obviously, it's a very severe problem. And what frustrates me, and I will state this, is that oftentimes the fingers are pointed to the rural areas of this state, and in fact, many of these places exist in the urban areas, and I think the urban areas have gotten off scot-free for far too long. And that is why I wanted to come up with a program that was specifically geared toward an equal application of the law, both in urban areas and in rural areas. I mean, we're very close to having the EPA declare the Lower Willamette River a Superfund site, this equal to Love Canal. And when you think about that, our major urban area in this state exists right on that segment of the river. That's something very serious in terms of the health and welfare of the people of this state and of my district especially. And so I wanted to come forward with a program that would be far-reaching and would probably be rather controversial, which has never bothered me tremendously much. But I'd like to point out that in another version of this, which was SB 617 still is and was Dash 1 Amendments, the definition of pesticide under that covers everything. I mean, it covers your Clorox bleach, it covers soft scrub, it covers just about everything. And I liked it in how we dealt with it. We narrowed it down and we said, yes, those cleaning substances, we aren't going to make every janitor sit down and write down every time they use one. We aren't going to fill out a form for that because that would be absolute overkill. I mean, yes, perhaps that data would be useful, but who in the world, what kind of department are we going to set up to deal with that sort of thing? And so by narrowing the focus, I think it was very wise. Additionally, creating hotlines and creating public records where people have filed complaints of toxic substances and keeping those on file so that the public is able to observe repeat offenders. I personally like that very much. Our job is to protect the public. That's why we're here. And so in touring my district, and I know my district has severe problems. It's the industrial district of the state. And a lot of companies try very hard, but in fact a lot of companies as DEQ has found, especially cut corners at times. And they generate a large amount of hazardous substances. And so we've discussed these things in great detail. We've had meetings with the state fire marshal to see if a program could fit into their system. We've met with the Department of Agriculture to see if it could fit in theirs. We've met with DEQ. And we spent a lot of time in seeing where it would fit because personally I don't want to start up a new department. I don't want to start up a new layer of government. and I want to make whatever we do fit into the existing structure. And with luck, to be able to have all the different departments be able to communicate with each other and to have useful data for each department. So I think personally with the Dash 4s, I think we've come about as far as we're going to come with this, at least in this session. And I'm personally satisfied. Any questions, statements, or involvements of... Whoa, this is a lot quieter than it was on Thursday.
I need you to keep talking until I get my laser pointer down here. Though.
You need me to keep talking. Boy, after this amount of information that we put together, personally, and I'll tell you from a very personal point of view, I really like Senator Brown's bill that we have put into this bill. And I want to make absolutely certain that that does not disappear in any way, because having little ones, as I stated in the Thursday's hearing, it's very important to me as a parent to know what's going on, to know what my kids are going to be exposed to, so that as a parent I can make a reasonable decision as to what is safe and what is not. Personally, I don't want to have to rely on the government to tell me what is safe and what is not. I want that to be my decision, and I want that to be each parent's decision. And so I'm personally very glad that that's part of this bill. I also like the part that got it the Newburgh pool, and to make certain that especially any drinking water is determined to be safe prior to the people consuming that drinking water, and that if it is not safe, that we do whatever is necessary to clean it up and make it safe prior to allowing our citizens to consume that liquid. Is your laser pointer rapidly coming, or am I...
You need to ask me a question. I don't know how
okay.
I had the Dash 4. It's been fairly hot off the press. In fact, it just got cool. You and I think it's a burden on parks and school districts relative to posting. Have you had a chance to review those?
Yeah.
Okay.
I have. And personally, as we discussed before, not in committee, but that they found it to be quite a burden in sending out individual notices to each parent, especially under circumstances of changing weather conditions or something where, in fact, they were intending to spray and then the weather changed and they put it off for another week or something. I mean, they'd have to send repeated notices. And on that, I think it's a reasonable compromise that we decided that, in fact, posting within the school so that those who were there, whether parents or whether visiting the school in some way so that they could be aware of what was going to take place was adequate. And we've done several things in this bill to reduce the fiscal impact. Personally, I think with the fiscal impact that has recently come out, I think DEQ rather padded their estimates, and I have a feeling it might need additional pairing involving DEQ, but as you well know, when we first discussed this issue, I personally did not want a heavy involvement of DEQ simply because every time we get them involved, it costs a great deal of money, and I knew that that would happen again, and in fact it has. That's why we first looked at the state fire marshal because they tend to be much more cost effective. Department of Agriculture is almost always more cost effective. And that is the route I preferred going, as you probably recall, Mr. Chair.
Like your home.
Thank you very much.
I'll go ahead and let you know. We'll drop the light probably over here.
Okay, is that about right? Okay, right on. Okay, one of the major issues as we looked at this bill was, what are we going to do about some of the costs? And Senator Wilde just mentioned the cost to school districts, and we attempted to find out all we could about what it would cost to implement such a program. It was a bit of a shock to both Senator Wilde and I to find out how big of gaping holes there are in this process. One of them is the idea of agencies who apply pesticides and what happens as far as the recording. Some of the mentions in the bill, you'll notice, are referred to posting material safety data sheets and that sort of thing. And what I did was I brought some of the stuff from home, and many of you will recognize this if you have any kind of business that has any kind of chemicals at all. This has everything from WD-40 hand cleaners on actually pesticides, and so you'll recognize this book. This is very inexpensive, and what the bill suggests that this will be kept available for the public so they'll be able to see what is being used, you know, particularly parks and that sort of thing. This is a catalog. Gentler's began as basically out of a shop farming operation. It started addressing particular needs of, of posting and requirements. And a lot of the things I have here today are actually from them. This is not a commercial for Gentler's, by the way. But a lot of the stuff that I brought from home is like this one right here. It talks about proper handling. These are things that most places would, in fact, have this present school district should have it. This is very inexpensive off the shelf. In fact, I'm going to post those in just a minute, how inexpensive they are. Signage, the signs that are necessary for posting, for example, a lawn that's been sprayed, would not be as expensive as this. This is a plastic-coated sign. Some of the ones we looked at cost as little as 29 cents each, so there should not be a major issue. A proper posting relative to children. We're doing Eddie Eagle Bill right now with the children so they know how to handle guns. It's an appropriate thing that they also understand how to handle toxic chemicals. Another thing that almost everyone should have present are books like this. This is called Marks, and what it does is it tells you everything you need to know about reporting. And one of the things I'm going to be dealing with is on what is required now as far as reporting and where we need to go. And so other things that are available, this is a training piece. What this thing does, it folds backwards. You've all seen something like this when they're trying to sell you insurance or Amway. And what the thing does is it gives you an opportunity to train employees. Very simple thing. These are relatively low cost. I'm going to go ahead right now and move to that. Could you go ahead and drop the light? This is actually from the Marks book, and this talks about what requirements are presently, what things are.
Marks or
who was that? Yeah, or Carl. What this indicates, let me come right down here to Oregon, and you'll see when you look at Oregon, our requirements for commercial operators is already pretty extensive. You can see that there's a lot of states that have bigger gaping holes than we do within that process. One of the things we discovered was that may not apply to state-run operations or school districts and that sort of stuff as far as the data that's recorded. This is what is necessary for a private applicator, and you see it's very limited here, down here at where Oregon is, unless they use restricted use pesticides. Then they pop up recording at the level of the commercial operator. And of course, here's a Gempler catalog. You can see this available to anyone, so this is not like an issue that's going to cost a lot of money to find out where it is. What I'd like to do right now is talk about some of the prices on these commodities. If you look right here at the bottom, the complete kit, which is called the starter kit, including the marker signs and everything else with all the training equipment, prices out at $49.95. That price hasn't changed. For the signs themselves, You can see, depending on the kind of size, the price range $1.98 to as much as $5, depending on what size you use and what it's made up of, what kind of material. The main thing that we're talking about here is, just as agriculture does now, it's reasonable that people would be notified as to what products were being used out there. Of course, this is, again, some of the reference material that I made reference to. As you can see, that booklet that I hold up was priced in at about $39, so it's not a real major issue. Here again, more of the safety training equipment and recording books. Here, this is something that we felt, when the reason the Dash 4 includes this is that there are systems right now. You notice this is a wipe-off unit, basically to be posted in the hallway. These are available not only from this source, but others. And you would literally mark in what was going to be applied, and then people would have an opportunity to look at it. Also, you'll notice that most of these pieces are done in they're bilingual, so that and a lot of them actually have it on both sides. So you have both English and Spanish and other languages where necessary available on a single page. Training videos, as you'll notice, I highlighted down here Michigan coming in at about $27.95, Idaho at $26 for their training video. Those are actually very excellent training videos. You can also get those on a checkout basis from our Oregon OSHA. We were anticipating this article. I don't know if you noticed this. This was Saturday, this last Saturday. DEQ to decide to control gas fumes at the barge dock. Talks about air testing in the Portland area. We anticipated that that was coming, and in fact, Dash 4 reflects the fact, because of its cost that was anticipated from DEQ, that was in fact removed. The point of this is that we have an opportunity, I believe, to pass out a bill that does address some relatively amazing things to me. Number one, that when something is reported, that it may not in fact be addressed, as Senator Wild had spoke to. The other issue is that we have children who may be in parks or in school districts who may be exposed to substances that neither they nor the parents know about. And the solution, of course, we believe is relatively low cost. Now you say course theory, it's very easy to say this is low cost, but what about the people who have to write it down and the FTEs necessary to carry this out? Here again, one of the things that's been occurring over the last 30 days or so is we've been asking questions in ways and means of some of the agencies about what they intend to do. In the Department of Ag Chief, we make reference to the pesticide education for homeowners. Department of Ag will probably speak to that and be talking about they're already doing that. This enhances that process. We have some folks in the chemical industry who said they already do programs like this, and other states will be eager to participate within forestry and Department of Agriculture and a couple of other agencies. They already record a lot of this data. What this would be doing is basically organizing it, and the work that would be done by OSU would be bringing that data together so that you, in fact, would be able to analyze the usage of these chemicals with any given watershed. So that would be very beneficial, I believe, to know what was happening within each watershed. So in summary, because I don't want to use up too much time here, we believe that it's a balanced, paced approach. We're going to find out in a few minutes about what some of the agencies think about some of our estimates of cost. We do have, one of the questions I've asked both of DEQ and Department of Ag is, do you have a laboratory? And the answer was yes. What would it cost to more extensively use that? And the answer was, well, probably not too much more. And one of the issues that came up when we were at OMSI with the first meeting of this committee was the idea that we have a lot of young people in the university system who are perfectly willing to come out and volunteer at their time. It's a great experience for them. Talking with watershed committee groups and soil conservation districts, they said they would feel well qualified to go out and actually pull the sampling that would be necessary on studying the streams as part of the bill. And so what we've attempted to do is to come up with a process that does, in fact, organize, compile data, does some of that basic research and does hold, particularly when it comes to water quality, that may in fact affect drinking water, that we know exactly what we're doing before we do it. So thank you very much.
In the Department of Environmental Quality, we have Lori Onan and Rick Cates.
I'll do my best. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Lori Onan with the Department of Environmental Quality, and with me is Rick Gates, who's the Administrative Laboratory Division. And I can tell we'll obviously be talking with you about fiscal estimates. We've heard that loud and clear, and we're prepared to answer as many of those questions as we can. What I wanted to do is make some general comments on the Dash 3 and Dash 4. I guess the Dash 4 amendments are intended to supersede Dash 3, sort of quick look through those. But the first comment is that the amendments do cover important issues, which are providing more information on clean water and toxics issues. And we certainly appreciate the goal of the bill and the amendments to give more attention to these matters. I appreciate the time spent in looking at these issues, and certainly are glad to have this discussion. I think the key concerns for DEQ are the need for adequate funding, which we'll certainly get into a discussion about. The Dash 3 and Dash 4 amendments would require significant new resources to implement on the part of DEQ. The other thing is, in reading through the Dash 3s and the Dash 4s, I think there's a need to better understand what the amendments seek to do. As written, the proposed amendments in some areas cast a very broad net in terms of water quality testing and looking at drinking water and hazardous substances. That's one of the reasons that the fiscal was larger in terms of the language was pretty broad, and we weren't quite sure what was intended. The other thing I wanted to point out was that there is a provision in the bill to mandate DEQ. Senator, I'll look at the Dash 4s and realizing this is my first look at it. On page 16, the discussion about testing for hazardous substances on all rivers and streams on the 303D list at least every 6 months, and such things as amount of any hazardous substances detected in the waters and estimates of source location for the substances. That was one thing where we weren't sure what types of things were being looked for. We could assume a list of 100 hazardous substances or more or less, so that's something we weren't quite sure. And then page 17, section 21, investigating all reports about symptoms of exposure to toxic or hazardous substances. And then, of course, this section further gets into a cause and effect relationship, which Rick can address in more detail, which is often a very difficult and expensive task. The last point I wanted to make was actually on page 17, section 22, requiring DEQ to develop and implement a program to record all complaints and the outcome of investigations. And I point this out because in my discussions with the regional offices, I think complaint response is one of the most frustrating things staff deal with, in the sense that they're not always able to respond to all complaints as fully as they would like to. And this is a condition of a lack of sufficient resources, in that you split staff time between permitting and technical assistance and enforcement and complaint response. So what usually happens is that only the most serious complaints will get a lot of attention. So it's something that I believe we'd like to do more of, and people feel that there's a lack of resources to cover it as much as they'd like to. With that, I'll close, and Rick and myself can answer any questions.
One of the things that you notice if you go back and look at the salmon plant or Senegal 1010, if you're in a rural area, for example, forestry, and in the city, you're going to probably, if you get a complaint in Portland, you're going to refer.
Senator George, you're right. There's a lot of jurisdictions that could look into complaints, and in fact, we do often refer complaints to various jurisdictions. But what we found is those are often also a little bit resource short in some cases, and unfortunately, folks may always get the response from those as they like, and so complaints can come back, and I know that does happen.
For the record, my name is Rick Gates. I'm a laboratory administrator with CEQ. And to further carry on from Laurie's comment, on Section 18, which is the water monitoring section, there were two areas that we had trouble getting a grip on how far this was intended to go. The first area is in the definition of a hazardous substance. In reading the definitions, it appears that it's using the fire marshal's definition of the hazardous substance. And in talking to the fire marshal's office this morning, they indicated that basically a hazardous substance is any substance that has an MSDS sheet associated with it. And when I asked them, do you have any idea how many chemicals that involves at this point, they said about 45,000. And we just don't know how to get a handle on that. Admittedly, many of those are compressed gases, which are probably not involved in this type of monitoring issues. But the sheer scope of the number of chemicals that might be asked to be analyzed for is extremely overwhelming, and I'm not sure it's even possible. The other issue that...
Can I focus in on something? So right now we're allowing chemicals to be used and maybe discharged into water. How to test for them, we don't even know what, don't have a background on that.
All chemicals that are used in the state would have MSDSs associated with them, so there is some information on those. We do not test every discharge for every possible chemical. Our engineers will go in and look at the processes and determine what are the most likely water pollution parameters to be tested for, and are there any other types of chemical screenings that would be needed in terms of volatile organics, semi-volatile organics, and heavy metals that we would need to be looking at. And that's usually done on a specialized case. With a discharger discharging, they have a discharge permit that would put limits on those substances if they were found to be in their processes that they might be discharging, and they would have to be monitoring for those. And then we would periodically, through our inspectors, go around and do compliance checks on those discharges.
DC and UC shall develop a coordinated program. Don't you see attempt to address the concerns that are laid out in the bill?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a helpful clarification. I think that if, in fact, this would be a pilot program or something, that would be that would need to be indicated and maybe the scope of it narrowed somewhat. That's one of the reasons we thought we were uncertain about what the intent was.
That's one reason that you also have the provisions in the bill that you would report.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really curious about the lab. You could get in your how what kind of an operation is it, and how many, what can you test for?
Mr. Chair, well, we're basically a full environmental testing lab. The things that we don't test for are most of the pesticides, which we defer to the Department of Agriculture, and microbiological samples, which the Department of Health Laboratory, Division of Health Laboratory does for us. And dioxin is about the only other chemical we don't do. We farm out. We will take samples in and contract with another lab to do those. But other than that, we cover just about all the environmental parameters that are listed as hazardous substances through either the hazardous air pollutants or through Appendix 8 of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, which is a list of hazardous substances through EPA. The other issue, if I may, Mr. Chair, is the number of samples that is being asked to be collected through this. Every 303D listed water body. Currently there's about 1,100 listed water bodies, and doing those twice a year, that's about 2,300 samples, which is equates to about 10 samples every Monday through Friday every day. And that's a tremendous workload going to anybody to try and do a complete analysis on those. Through existing resources, I mean, we would have to add additional resources on to pick up and do additional 10 samples a day. And it's just a matter of how many people and how many instruments does the state want to pay to gear up to do that. What I was going to try and suggest is many of the 303 Daedalus streams are listed solely for temperature. In fact, more than half of them are all listed for just temperature, and otherwise they may have excellent water quality associated with them. And Mr. Chair, that would be a considerable difference if we could develop a plan to put together. I think we would want to work from going up where we felt there would be the most likelihood of finding something and scaling up accordingly and getting coverage over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to ask you, when you get a water sample, how do you determine what you are going to test for? Because obviously you're saying you do not test for all these different substances, so how do you make the determination, what are you going to test for?
Well, we make Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, usually we're in conversation with whoever is collecting that sample, asking what are they interested in finding. And at that point, they would tell us either they're looking for volatiles or they think they have semi-volatiles. If they come to us and ask, we just have no idea what's in this, could you do a complete scan, then we will gear up and go accordingly.
Thank you. So if I'm a municipal sewage treatment plant and I'm discharging into a river, how do we know what's being discharged if, in fact, we aren't testing for everything?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, at some point, at least one sample has been pulled off of that sewage treatment system and looked for everything that they would be required under their permit.
So when we are, in fact, telling the public, this is all safe, this is fine and dandy, we don't really know that because we haven't even tested for it. Would that be a correct statement?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, you can always make that statement. I mean, there's just no way we're going to be able to check for any of the 70 or 80,000 synthetic chemicals that are out there. We don't think they are all causing problems.
Well, this is a quandary I'm having because if we're going to list something as dangerous or hazardous, which then restricts a person's ability to use it, and yet on the other hand, we say if it does a discharge, we don't really know that it's going to be of that great concern. I'm having a great difficulty in how we deal with this. Either on the front end, it's a great concern, and on the back end, it should be a great concern, or it shouldn't be a great concern the whole way through. And that's what we're trying to get at is, develop something that is consistent through the process of if it is a hazardous chemical or a dangerous one, we want to follow the way it's applied and we want to follow where it goes and who it impacts and what it impacts.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, if I could start the answer because I think I can hear a little bit of the continuing frustration that we don't have enough information, and I think we would agree we don't in all cases. In the way DEQ is set up, a lot of attention right now is set on making sure that we meet the water quality standards that are under the Clean Water Act. And that's where you get into federal laws and even state laws don't look at every chemical that might be getting into the water. So we're focused on certain things that have been defined as things that we need to pay attention to, and Rick can describe more of that. Where you're looking and going beyond that, that's where you, I think we're getting into, it's a large universe, and how do we figure out exactly what we should spend time looking at, which is, I think, part of the discussion with this bill. And I don't know, Rick, if you want to add.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, we approach that through a couple different areas. In looking at discharges, we periodically go out and try to do what we call mixing zone studies, which look at the discharge of a discharger and the mixing zone in the receiving water body to see if we can see biological effects or other secondary indicators that might indicate there's either a toxicity problem or some other kind of a biological issue that might be there.
Mr. Chair, I think that was all of our prepared comments. We'd certainly be happy to answer more questions.
So at a point, we have a discharge from the sewer treatment plant. Committee in court. Discharge. I mean, we may know the fecal material that we know.
Mr. Chair, there is quite a bit of testing that's required of the individual sewage treatment plants, and they have a fairly good handle of what's coming into their systems through their pretreatment program, in which industries that are discharging to the sewage treatment plant have to do their own testing and reporting to the individual sewage treatment plant system. And the sewage treatment plants do much more testing probably than what I'm aware of, just being associated with the laboratory, and report this information to the department. And I believe much of this toxicity testing that they do is reported, and we do have somewhat of a handle. Clearly, you're correct, though. We don't know everything about every possible pollutant that may be in there.
The issue that's repeatedly come up is the idea that nobody seems to compile this. I mean, other than the fire marshal, who seems to know where every chemical in the state is and has it on the Internet, most other folks, when we talk to them, we find out that they really don't keep a running inventory. In fact, I asked a question about, you know, methylethyl bad thing dumped into a high-tech plant in Beaverton and hitting the sewer treatment plant and killing all the bacteria, whatever happened there. Hypothetical. And you know, who keeps a record of everything like that? And the direction is that I think the bill is trying to address is the fact that somebody ought to. Somebody should. And I see heads nodding here. What is interesting is that when we're going to hear from the fire marshal, and this is not to glorify the fire marshal day here, but what was interesting when we talked to them to find out how QFTE actually compiled that data. And that'll, I think, be interesting. You folks will see through their presentation. I think it may be how they handle that data. Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
Brad, who's up next?
State Fire Marshal's Office, Bob Albers.
Question before you start. Did you bring the big book with 110,000 chemicals?
Senator George, no, I didn't bring that. You were referring to the list of the chemicals that are reported within the state? No, I didn't bring that particular one.
Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed when you're ready.
My name is Bob Albers. I am with the Office of State Fire Marshal. I am the State Fire Marshal's Hazardous Materials Services Programs Manager. I'm involved with the State Community Regional Hazardous Substance Information Program and have responsibility for implementation and carrying out of that particular program. We have brought for the committee a document. It is a questions and answers document. And this lists out, this particular document lists out the questions that are most frequently asked about our hazardous substance information system and community regional program. And that's the first page inside the cover. And if you're interested in any of those particular questions, we've addressed and answered each of those questions within this document. Also, you'll find a copy, written copy of the comments that I have to make today, and you'll also see two summary sheets that are attached to the front of that particular document. And what these are summary statements having to do with two specific items that we were asked to come and speak to today. We were asked to do three things. We were asked to come and provide a brief overview of the Upstate Fire Marshal's Hazardous Substance Information Program, and to speak to two components that are contained within the proposed legislation, specifically having to do with requiring an affirmative duty for reporting hazardous substances, and the second having to do with enhancements to access of hazardous substance information via the Internet. And as we go through, that's what I'm going to attempt to do. First off, what is it that the Fire Marshal's Office does? What do we do as related to hazardous substance? What we do is we find out where the hazardous substances are located in the state. We do this by surveying. Currently, we are surveying right at 41,000 companies. I've got listed here 40,890, but we're continually adding new companies, and at the time that this particular document was put together, that's how many companies we were surveying. What we do is we annually send a survey out to companies, and we annually send out surveys to fixed site locations, both private business and public sector, and ask them what kinds of hazardous substances they have. If you were to summarize what it is that we provide a targeting tool. Our hazardous substance information reports help people to target where they want to spend their time and resources conducting hazardous substance-related activities. Our reports show where hazardous substances that may impact the communities and the environment are located. Our reports will tell you what kinds of hazardous substances a facility has, how much, what's the most that they would have on site at any given time, how much hazardous substance is transported into a facility, how much is transported out of a facility. That information can be translated into production information. It can be translated into sales information. Our reports provide information about what the hazards are that are associated with hazardous substances that are being used, stored, manufactured, and produced around the state. This information, again, can be used as a tool to identify where people might want to have emphasis reporting programs, emphasis programs that target specific substances or specific types of businesses that it's been identified that a particular chemical used by a particular type of business may have detrimental impacts on the environment. And folks can use our information to target where they want to spend the time and their money and their resources finding these types of things. That's generally what our information reporting program is. Senator George had referred to the number of FTE that we have assigned to our program. I hadn't specifically put that information in, but I'll go ahead and address it. We have a staff of four people that receive and process our surveys, actually mail out, receive, and then data enter our surveys each and every year. We have a staff of four people that validate the information that we receive, and then we have an additional four people that are involved in our program that are involved with the dissemination aspect of it. We provide this information to in a variety of different formats. I'll get into that a little bit later, but we have staff that's there to actually disseminate the information. I think it's appropriate to point out, in terms of the type of the information that we're receiving in relationship to some of the information that is gathered by other agencies, the complexity of which our reports require folks to report is safely be stated as far simpler and less complex than, as an example, reporting, identifying pollutants into a water stream or into an airstream. We do not, our program does not capture information about how much substance is released into the environment. What we do is we collect the information to tell folks where they can go and find where these substances are being used and where they're likely to be being released into the environment.
And those, you have the EPA
location for the chemical, location of where the plant or a company or a distributor probably could say very safely that if we picked up, that you might look for these following chemicals in this waste stream, say, headed to the treatment plant, based upon that.
Senator George, members of the committee, that is correct. We actually very recently added a field to our data collection system, and that is a requirement that those that have pesticides in reportable quantities, that they would identify the EPA pesticide registration for that substance. All pesticides that are manufactured or are required to obtain and have on a label the pesticide EPA pesticide identification number. And we now require companies to report that information. You can look at the standard industrial classification of a particular company in our reports, and what that standard industrial classification does is it identifies what type of an operation it is. If it is a wholesaler of farm products, pesticides, fertilizers, and what have you, you can identify those types of businesses from looking at the reports that we have. We can query our system to profile based on what type of business you're looking for. We can query and profile our reports based on the types of hazardous substances that you're looking for. I should also point out that in keeping with federal community right to know requirements, we do not require farm operations that solely operate as farm to submit reports to us. Under the federal EPRA requirements, they do not require farm operations to submit hazardous substance information reports specifically related to farm.
But all commercial operators would impact.
Senator George, members of the committee, that is correct. The way our system is set up is we are required by law to identify businesses and governmental agencies in the state that have the potential of having reportable quantities of hazardous substances. Then we're required by law to actually survey those particular businesses, which is a real good jump off and caveat to step into the affirmative duty aspect of this, if you like. As I stated, the current law does not require those who possess reportable quantities of hazardous substances to notify the Office of State Fire Marshal. They are not required to report to us unless we send them a survey. What the law requires is that we go out and we find businesses and governmental agencies that have hazardous substances or that have the potential of having hazardous substances, and then to send them a survey and ask them, do you have a reportable quantity of hazardous substances? The way we do that is we profile businesses and governmental entities based on their operational standard industrial classification. And based on that standard industrial classification, I don't know if any of y'all are familiar with or seen the standard industrial classification manual about IPA, but we go through those and based on common knowledge about businesses and our knowledge and our cohorts and other governmental agencies and our stakeholders in the business community, the industry rep, what we do is we identify which one of those standard industrial classifications are likely to have or be using hazardous substances. And then we have to go out and find them. And we've used a variety of different public records to do that. And the best one that we've landed on so far is actually employment records. Employment records, companies identify what type of a business operation they have by a standard industrial classification. We go in and we received a one-time dump of everybody that they had in the system and actually increased the number of companies reporting to us from 20,000 to 32,000 at that time. We then and continue to receive monthly updates from the employment office
of new businesses that are starting up and reporting to them in the state. We profile and look at the standard operation SOC, and then we will send a survey to the company and say, hey, you fall within this type of an operation? Do you have the potential of having hazardous substances? Do you? Tell us and report the information to us and complete the survey and submit it within 60 days. The challenge that exists is that a company can have multiple operations, multiple standard industrial classification operations. Perfect example is a Fred Meyer. A Fred Meyer is going to have a grocery store SIC. They're going to have an apparel store SIC, sporting goods, standard industrial classification SIC. They'll have a nursery, standard industrial classification. And they may choose to report their business as an apparel operation. So when we receive reports from the employment division, we look at the report, and the report says that this is an apparel shop. Apparel shops aren't likely to have hazardous substances, so we never survey them. And we are using, right now, we are using the best information available to us. We've used all kinds of different information. We even purchased private records to see if we couldn't come up with it. We're using the best information available, but even that isn't adequate to identify all of the companies that have reportable quantities of hazardous substances. We recognize, and it's recognized, that there are companies out there, businesses that have reportable quantities of hazardous substances that we're not surveying, and they're not required by law to call us and notify us that, hey, we have reportable quantities of hazardous substances. A affirmative duty requirement such as which is proposed in this particular piece of legislation would require a company to make notification to us that we have reportable quantities of hazardous substances, and we would then survey them. What it would do is we would then be able to provide more complete information about where the hazardous substances are being located in the state. And
I'll just ask a question about that. What you described a few minutes ago,
Senator George, members of the committee, that's a very good point. When we did an analysis of what the impact would be by going to affirmative duty versus non-affirmative duty, we would still seek out companies that should be reporting to us. We'd continue to use the employment records, and we would utilize those to make contact with companies that are not reporting to us that we believe that they should be reporting to us. What we believe would be the largest impact in terms of reduction in staff work would have to do in the area of companies that report to us but report that they don't have reportable quantities of hazardous substances. Of the 40,000 companies that are reporting to us, half of those companies have reportable quantities and the other report that they're below reportable quantities. What that means is they've got less than 50 gallons, 200 cubic feet, or 500 pounds of a hazardous substance on site at any given time. Half of the companies that report to us report that they're below those thresholds. We continue to keep those companies in our system because they fall within a group that has the potential of having reportable quantities. What we believe would happen if an affirmative duty requirement were to come out, we would have some of those businesses that would say, hey, we don't want to be reporting anymore, and we would simply simply go ahead and tell them, okay, if you don't want to report, that's fine. However, be aware that if you do receive reportable quantities, you're going to have to report to us at that time. We figure that the reduction in work is going to, for us, is really going to fall in the area of dealing with that particular group of folks. Where we would focus our attention is at better validating the information that we're receiving to see if the reports that we're receiving are accurate. As I stated earlier, we do have a staff of three folks that conduct audits of facilities. A good portion of the effort that we're putting into it right now have our off-site audits of records. We would spend more time doing on-site of actual hazardous substance inventories and to determine the validity of the reports that we're receiving. The second component that I was asked to speak to was the accessing of hazardous substance information. There is all kinds of hazardous substance information out there. Our office participated and staffed the governor's hazardous substance information reporting and community right to know
task force over the last 2 years during the interim between the last session. And Department of Agriculture, Department of Environmental Quality, Health Division, Office of Emergency Management, the State Fire Marshal's Office, EPA, there were representatives from the Eugene Toxic Right to Know Program, Lane County Air Pollution Program. The list goes on and on of different agencies that reported on either a hazardous substance notification program that they had, a hazardous substance permitting program that they had, or a hazardous substance information reporting system similar to, or not necessarily similar to ours, but more complex, more stringent reporting requirements that we have. The challenge, there's a lot of information that's available. We provide access to our information via we actually have a direct dial-up system that emergency responders and emergency planners can dial directly into our computer system and access the information that we have. We've got our information up on the Internet. We have a portion of our information up on the Internet. It took us 2 years to accomplish it, but we were able to put some basic information up on the Internet that provides people direct access to our database. We've still got a big chunk of it yet to get up there.
Bob, let me stop you right there and ask a question. Now, if I understood you right, and I think I may have missed one number, because I had some total of about 12 FTE that are involved in this whole process.
All right. Senator George, members of the committee, that is correct. That's the number of folks, not counting myself, also assigned to the program. We have another program within our community right to know program. It's a hazardous materials planning and response training assistance program. We have another 3 FDE that are involved in that program as well.
My point is this, as you just mentioned, that during the interim, the governor convened this process in order to look at this whole issue, basically providing the background for where we're headed with the bill. So what you've done is you've interacted with the agency similar to what we're describing in the bill, process basically so we have a better understanding. Is that what you were describing? In other words, Department of Ag, DEQ, everyone providing, you know, the portion that they know about. Is that what you were describing a few seconds ago when you were describing?
Chairman George, members of the committee, what the task force did is the task force requested that the state agencies make reports on the different types of reporting programs that they have, what information elements are collected, how the information is disseminated, how people can access the information, and that information was then evaluated by the task force members so that they could come up with recommendations on how to, on whether to or and how to enhance hazardous substance information reporting in the state.
Basically, anything that you develop that's working or any other agency that you can.
Chairman George, members of the committee, there's an example. Department of Environmental Quality in our office, Office of Emergency Management, Department of Agriculture. We've got some connects with the Department of Forestry. We as state agencies strive to coordinate the activities and the information that we have. There is no formal plan at this point in time to do that, to coordinate the information and between the agencies. We have been working towards and striving to establish a gateway, if you will, to hazardous substance information via internet access, The information is available out there. We have that available here. The challenge for folks in getting to the information is first off trying to figure out who's got what. Or who's got what information. We have a hotline, a hazardous substance information hotline that we staff with 4 people during our normal business hours, and we get phone calls from a lot of folks wanting to know, well, where can I get this information? Where can I get that information? Wanting a whole variety of different information that we don't have. And oftentimes we're not even sure where they can get it. But the point being is that there is information that's available. And I think it's appropriate to also point out that there's information that's available, but there has been identified gaps in the information that's available. And I think that's some of the things that a lot of folks are trying to address this year through the legislative process.
it's difficult for folks to get this information, and what a lot of folks think is that, hey, internet access to this information is a good way to get it. And that's true. It's a good, viable way to access the information, but it's still, having internet access is laced with its own set of problems. One, getting the info, first off, is that some agencies may or may not have the information electronically available. So that means they got to get it electronically available. That's getting electronically available on a computer. Now,
so do you know how many households have internet access?
Chairman George, Senator Corcoran, do I know of any houses that have internet access?
Do you know what percentage of homes have internet access?
No, sir, I do not know that.
Thank you.
I do not know that. The State Fire Marshal's Office, in addition to having our information up on the internet, we had the bulletin board system, the electronic bulletin board system, and we have contacted libraries around the state and have the libraries connected up to our bulletin board system. So if somebody wants to go to one of the libraries that have access to our information, they can actually come directly into our bulletin board system from a library. The difficulty again is for folks once they get onto the internet, and that's okay. Where do I get what information? And there's a whole different language and a whole different set of problems that come up for agencies wanting to put the internet up there. Our sister agencies within the state government, we've had lots of discussion on this. We are truly moving forward and trying to enhance the ability for people to get into this, but we're all faced with the same problems. And if you have staffing problems, you have staffing shortcomings. We don't have any one person dedicated in our office to setting up or maintaining an internet access. This particular bill and the proposal to do that, we've looked at that, and some of the things that, based on the conversation we have, and if we understand what it is that we would need to be doing, is providing enhancements to internet access to hazardous substance information, all of the information, establish hyperlinks between agencies that would create a type of one-stop or a gateway to hazardous substance information. We have an intern that we're going to bring on board this summer that's going to research the internet to identify all the hazardous substance information databases that exist and try to categorize those. And we're also going to do the same thing for hazardous substance information training, and again, to try to categorize those. We're going to collect the information and be able to collect it, find out where the hyperlinks are, find out who the contact people are. But that's kind of like scratching the surface of what needs to be done on. But we're trying to move towards that in line with some of the things that are here. This proposal, we say it would make hazardous substance more available to members of the public, simplify the process of obtaining hazardous substance information. Information going up on the internet actually makes timelier information too. Our information has been, you could get the information that we get within 30 days after we get it because we've had our bulletin board system. One of the things you have to understand when you're looking at internet access to databases or any kind of electronic system, bulletin board system, you're looking at a set finite group of queries. And the queries are not going to take and produce the type of information maybe needed by a particular group that wants to look at particular types of impacts. They're going to have customized, they're going to need more customized reports, or they may need the entire database, the entire dump of the database so that they can manipulate the information the way that they want to. We provide those kinds of things to folks when they want to access our information system. But we look at this in terms of establishing a central access point to hazardous substance all the hazardous substances posted up on the internet. As I said, we're moving towards this. We already have an intern lined up for the summer to take and work with a college student, and we're going to move towards that with. This is not something that's in our approved budget for this year in terms of position authority for an additional person to work the internet access. If we don't receive that, we'll continue to move forward, but it's going to be slow going. As I said earlier, to get one component of our information system up there took us 2 years.
And this is not just a challenge that our agency is dealing with, it's a challenge that all state agencies would and are going to be dealing with.
Come and ask for one FTE, though. An interesting point.
Just on the affirmative duty side of this, we've costed that out. There is no additional cost to the state to implement an affirmative duty requirement. If you look at the report, there is, new reporters are going to incur some costs associated with the tracking and reporting. We would not incur any additional costs from that. We would just roll that into the rest of our operation to enhance the internet access the way that we're understanding that the folks are wanting us to do it. We look at that, and we would need one FTE, actually an information specialist, that would be charged with doing nothing but these particular items.
Chairman George, members of the committee, that is correct. We did some reorganization and are able to free up our primary information person that we have now that works at enhancing our database that we have, our in-house database. And this fall, we will be working with businesses that are currently reporting into us to begin accepting electronic submission of hazardous substances to us. We already accept, we're the state designated recipient of toxic release inventory information that's required by by federal EPA. EPA requires companies that have toxic releases of certain substances when they have it above a certain threshold. They have to report how much went in the water, how much went in the air, how much went in the ground. We're the state designated recipient of that information, and we receive that information via electronic media. We're already receiving those reports electronically. Our own reporting system, we haven't got there. EPA spent probably 3 years getting to the point where they could accept it, the TRI report electronically.
Thank you very much. Very informative.
Oregon Department of Agriculture, Lorna Young.
I think we should have each successive agency take longer than the previous one. I think we should make this like a
kind to one another. Welcome.
I think this is really helpful.
Senator George, Senator Corcoran, I'm afraid I'll disappoint you.
Good.
I wanted to thank you for the opportunity to comment on the bill. I'll reference the Dash 4 amendments. And what we wanted to clarify, when Section 6 and Section 7, your goal is to try and essentially create the same responsibility that for public applicators and that you have currently for commercial operators and applicators. And if that is in case what you're proposing to do, we would like to submit a proposed change or amendment. 634 is not a very straightforward law. You would think if you removed an exemption, you would create a responsibility, but 634 doesn't work quite as clearly as that. So what we'd like to propose is in the definition of pesticide operator, which is in the very beginning of the law, in the definition sections of 634.006, that we clarify in the section of the definition of a pesticide operator to also include public entities. Once you do that, once you create the addition that a public pesticide operator is also a public agency which uses or causes use of pesticide on its own lands or is a utility, then everything else flows from there. The requirement to license, the requirement to keep records. We would propose also that we do exempt them from the fiscal responsibility section that applies to commercial operators because obviously public entities have to carry their own insurances. So we'd like to propose those changes to make your purpose clearer in the law. And so I'd be happy to provide those to your administrator. The it's a difficult law to deal with. We've dealt with it for years, but there's been a lot of changes and additions and maybe rewrites in order.
Senator Corcoran?
So when did you see the Dash 4 amendments?
Senator George, Senator Corcoran, I saw the Dash 4 amendments when I came in here at 4:30. but the dash threes and the dash fours are the same when it referencing the section related to public applicators.
So you came in to speak on threes?
I came in prepared to speak on threes, but I can just speak on the fours because there's not substantial changes in the fours to those sections that we were prepared to comment on.
But you hadn't seen the threes, I mean the fours before you came in today?
No.
Well, that's my point. I mean, they weren't available. Nobody's even seen them. I think the dash ones you had 24 hours beforehand.
We would also like to comment on Section 18, which is the section that requires a develop and implement a coordinated program for water quality testing. As I'm sure you're well aware, monitoring of anything will absorb as much of resources as you want to throw at it. And I think probably the concern that both we and the DEQ share is the section called implement, because that's where the money comes in. I think we'd be both very happy as agencies to develop a program. And my suggestion might be that you figure out how much money you think you can throw at this program, and then we can develop a program around that rather than asking us for a fiscal impact. Because, for example, if you're looking at pesticide residues, I'm going to ask you, do you want the standard multi-residue screen at 300, or do you want the that goes to parts per billion, or do you want parts per trillion and a four, you know, screen? So it becomes very difficult up front to tell you what we could do. It would be far easier if you set some target levels. We could tell you what you could buy for that much, and if you want more, this is what more it would take. But obviously the fiscal situation with natural resources is a difficult one. So that's what would be our suggestion, is to set a target amount, and we'll design a program and then implement to the best of our ability within what resources are available.
Or with the amendments that you already have, if we went on page 16, line 18, and we went in, because there is part of this bill that is begin to develop a program, and then we did put implement in there. And if you bracketed that and implement out of there, because we have already things that we would like to direct you to start doing, and then you're going to be reporting back to the interim anyway, I think that may be something that will be more reasonable, because we're going to be looking to you folks.
Mm-hmm.
Come up with a plan on how the whole thing fits together. So rather than straight jacket you with explicit language to give you that instruction that this is where we want to go.
Senator George, I agree that would be very helpful. Then we can work in an iterative fashion with you to design a program that would meet the needs. Because clearly, if we had the resources to do a lot of monitoring now, that's exactly what we'd be doing. I'd also like to point out that Section 19, in which you direct us to implement a comprehensive pesticide use education program, we currently do have a program option package in the governor's recommended budget that would give us resources to do just that, and that was arising out of a lot of suggestions that came from the Willamette program. So our fiscal impact statement has included in it the two positions that we had asked for to do that in the budget already. And that concludes my testimony.
That is one of your packages.
Now, one thing in Section 19 that I wanted in there was that it does apply to urban areas, because that's an area where people do take their diazinon and go out and dump it in any way they darn well feel like it. They take, they apply their fertilizers when it's raining. I just watched my neighbor do it the other day. They're good environmentalists, and it was all just washing right down the street. And I think it's kind of necessary to educate these people, because for them, going to the garden store and spending $20 on chemicals is no big deal. And if it doesn't do exactly what they want, they go out and buy a different chemical. Whereas to a farmer, generally speaking, that's their profit margin they're spraying on, and if they have to do it twice, they might well have lost their profit. So they pay a great deal more attention than most of the urban dwellers that I've observed. So I want to make sure that it would get directed in that way.
Senator George, Senator Wild, precisely how we intended to use it. Thank you.
Okay, so basically what we ask you to do, you're almost underway. Spend money.
Then we get the resources.
Thank you very much. Randy's up next.
Is this from McMurdo here? Mr. McMurdo? Sorry, we don't have him here.
Okay.
Johnson from the Health Division?
Tom, we hope we've solved your problem with Dash 4.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Johnson, an assistant administrator for the Oregon Health Division. I have with me today Mr. Dave Leland, who's the manager of the state drinking water program. Chair George, yes, I think that you have. We seriously saw the dashboards as we came and understand that they're just available. I suppose our comments are just to clarify what our role would be in the dashboards, and as we read it, want to confirm that the DEQ will be the one that will be determining the appropriateness of the source water for drinking water sources, and they would simply report that information to us, that we would have the responsibility to, in then approving any new drinking water programs, to check simply to see if that source that is being proposed to be used has been approved by DEQ as a source for drinking water. I'd like to make just a couple of other comments. Our program deals with and regulates the quality of water that is consumed, ready for consumption, after treatment, not necessarily then the source of the water. The source of the water could be a whole bunch of different things. After treatment, that is what we apply our standards to. There are 84 standards that we apply for chemicals and other sorts of things that we have a large database on about the tests that are done by the drinking water systems on the water that is actually put into the pipes in the distribution system. We collect that information. We have that available. We, too, are experimenting with putting that on the Internet and having that available to all. I guess the questions that we would have is how DEQ would go about determining whether a source is appropriate for drinking water, how they would go about that, what standards they would apply. It appears as though, from the wording in the bill, that this would be done on information gained from sanitary surveys that we require drinking water programs to conduct periodically. Our question would be, are those sanitary surveys that are conducted now going to provide that information? Would we be turned to require a different kind or a different degree of sanitary surveys that would be done to get at that information that then would be available to DEQ? And with that, I guess those are sort of our statements about the bill, what we see our role, sort of the questions, the issues that we might have, and would be available for any questions or to receive direction from the committee.
I think we can ask a question relative to obviously, this is designed to deal with new. What do you mean right now, the prospects for that? Termination.
Does the person make a decision? Do they need an agency to make a decision?
That's probably not a good idea, and I think that's what we were trying to address here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let's take a crack at that. It'll probably take both of us to try. Could you ask quite a few questions?
Okay.
We really determine whether the treatment plan that is put forward will reasonably treat the water to comply with the drinking water standards, of which there are 84. Basically the determination of the source to get the water from is a local determination. likely there is some interaction between the drinking. Yes.
I was reading a piece that was submitted to me talking about, I believe it was Wilsonville. So basically, if a city decided, yeah, we're going to go ahead and do it, then they would just approve.
So, Mr. Chair, we have a lab, a drinking water lab, that basically does the bacteriological. However, we certify drinking water labs, most of them which are private, which then do the chemicals and the BEQ agriculture. They can use whatever lab they want, even including the privates. But the issue really is, I think, one of trying to determine whether the source after treatment will comply with the drinking water standards that then we will apply to the finished drinking water. So where they want us to get involved is really up to them. Typically, I think there's involvement fairly early on, but where we would get involved officially for sure is at the point where they would submit to us a plan that we would need to review and approve for the construction of the drinking water plant. That's where we would get involved, and that's where there would be really the approval. If we looked at that plan and it was not sufficient in our estimation to do an appropriate treatment job to make the finished water so that it did comply with the drinking water standards, then we wouldn't approve the plan. I think that's. Okay?
If the city of Wilsonville, if in fact decided they were going to go ahead and use the water out of the Willamette, basically they would submit a plan for the treatment plant. They begin construction before they got a hold of you?
No. Senator George, members of the committee, long before, they would have to go through a planning process, developing a plan, and that plan would have to be submitted to us and approved before they could begin construction. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that likely would be the case in that situation. That discretion is up to us. We would want to make sure that the question that we need to answer is the plan as submitted likely to produce water that meets the drinking water standards? Whatever we would have to do to answer that question, it may be peer review, it may be going out and doing more studies or engineering studies, it may be having pilot treatment projects to go through the process and see whether it really works. Those things are discretionary things that we would use at our disposal to answer that question conclusively.
How do you think it would affect the process that you're now doing?
Sir George, members of the committee, this is sort of new. As I see this, first of all, the DEQ would likely be approached as to whether that source had within it contaminants that would may symptoms from tissue that may result in toxic hazardous substance in the water of the state. And if it does, then they would have the responsibility to declare the source as inappropriate.
Hang on. Lorna, could you folks come up and take these side mics? We love to do that.
This is good. We're sort of going through it, too. And because we have not talked, and we would love to do that.
So, again, I think from our point of view, the first thing that we would do is turn to the DEQ and say, is this source an approved source? And they likely will have gone through a process of making that determination.
I'll let each one of you identify yourselves again for the record and then tell us how you would approach it if, in fact, we were looking at Wilsonville. Because a lot of times a specific example can help identify the conditions of the bill, how it will function.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lori Onan, Department of Environmental Quality.
Mr. Chair, I'm Rick Gates, Department of Environmental Quality.
We were out in the audience just looking at this, and in fact had talked a little bit with Health Division about this before, and probably should have brought it up during our testimony. This particular section, and Rick can speak more to this, the difficulty comes in this part about confirming that signs or symptoms are the result of toxic or hazardous substances. As you may know, DEQ has done testing on fish in the Newburgh Pool area. In fact, some test preliminary results were just released a couple weeks ago. The difficulty comes in the cause and effect relationship and how you try to prove that through science. And I think Rick can say we haven't, in the studies we've done to date, confirmed. And I think prohibiting the use of water under that situation is not a role that we've had at all as a state agency. It hasn't been our role to prohibit uses of water for drinking water if it can be shown that it can be treated. So Rick could perhaps speak a little bit more to the science.
Mr. Chair, in trying to correlate the signs or symptoms such as skeletal deformities to a specific chemical toxin, I just don't know that that's even remotely possible. There are so many possibilities of what can cause that, and right now the studies that we've had and asked OSU to enter into on those particular fish species are still open in terms of is this parasitic, is this some sort of genetic, is this chemical. It's usually never as cut and dry as that. The only situations where we have really had much luck in correlating a specific chemical to causing either a fish die-off or something is where we're looking at a fairly high level still of something and can actually get in there and measure and correlate what killed the fish or what harmed it with a specific chemical. But most ambient levels, there's just a soup of possibilities out there that are, it's going to be very difficult to define.
Yeah, don't do that, okay? And what we're seeing right here is when you have symptoms present in a water source, and you make a determination that you can't determine what the problem is. And we are, for example, looking at Bull Run where we're using 8% of the water. And why don't you look for another alternative like enhancing storage capacity in Bull Run? I mean, there's all sorts of implications of that. Wilson's already done a moratorium. So they can handle what they have and what they have. They have two wells standing by at Damage. Okay, not a problem. But you would have the authority under this bill, I understand the way it's written correctly, to say, no, don't do that. Is that
correct? Mr. Chair, if I could answer that question. I think, again, it gets down to we don't necessarily see our role as prohibiting folks from making a local decision, assuming that they can go through all the required meeting all the standards. And that was what the Oregon Health Division was speaking to in terms of making sure that when that plan is built, it addresses what we know. Also, as written, it appears to us that Section 21 is written to be statewide. So that was another question that we had. It doesn't appear to limit it to any particular water.
That's the get-all report.
Right. Okay. Sure. Thank you. Sure.
Senator White.
I guess the thing that concerns me about this discussion is we have this obvious problem, which is our fish with the deformities, with lesions. We say that we test a large number of substances in the water, but we've had testimony that, in fact, that is limited. So we know this is taking place. We have set up a plan to treat this water and make it meet certain standards, but those standards admittedly do not take everything into consideration. So, in fact, we do not know that we have taken care of what may be the problem. And personally, I have a really difficult time having people consume that water with the problem still going on and saying, we don't know what's causing it, but believe us, this water is going to be great for you. I mean, that's tough for me to handle.
Sure, Senator Wild. Again, Tom Johnson, Oregon Health Division. I hear what you're saying, and again, you're correct. There are 84 standards that we test for. there may be many others that are in the river. There are more, in addition to the 84, coming online nationally. Hopefully we've gotten the ones that are of greatest significance to public health, but you're correct. What we apply to stand, what we do in terms of approving water as safe drinking water is those sources, those finished products which meet the standards that we have now. And we do not have standards for all of the elements that are in the water of virtually any drinking water sources in the state.
Okay, thank you all very much. Very, very informative.
Mr. Chair. While we're waiting for the next pony and the dog, the children are waiting for the next pony and the dog and pony show. I was wondering if you could respond to the material that's been in the news the last couple of days about a proposed compromise between the environmental community and the what that would do, the 1028 versus 617.
No idea.
Thank you.
Charlie Stone, Department of Forestry.
Thank you, Long Time, Senator. I am Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry. Out of this 21-page bill, there are 6 lines devoted to the direction to the Department of Forestry, and I hope to keep my remarks in proportion. The responsibilities for the Department of Forestry under this address: all hazardous substances used on public lands owned by or managed by the state forestry or state board of forestry. That, I don't think I'm stretching the point too far to say that would include the use of gasoline and diesel to propel vehicles across forest land. Senator Wild raised earlier on, we have hundreds of buildings that we operate and maintain on administrative sites and whatnot, so janitors using different materials and whatnot would appear to fall under this. I would like to suggest to the committee that a few words changed here might address the spirit of what the committee is trying to do a little bit more directly, and that would be to follow hazardous substances with applied to public forest lands instead of used on public lands. And I think that would still get to the use of pesticides and or, chemicals used in prescribed burning, that type of thing, but would not get us tangled up in all those things that we really wouldn't have any way to measure or know about. Yeah, Senator George, the department already keeps records on its application of pesticides and those types of materials, and that would not create a significant additional burden.
Okay. County's incident involving the oil. Kind of surprised me that we don't have a better outwater standard, the potential affecting people's drinking water. And so, can you tell us, is there a way to that, right? Or would this actually be applied to the potential? Well, how are we going to address that idea of people being careless with the antifreeze
on oil? Senator George, I'm not sure if we address it in full, but I would point out that the Forest Practices Act and its rules address the disposal of hydraulic fluids, oils, and that type of thing by prohibiting it on forest lands. An operator is not allowed under the Forest Practices Act to dig a pit and dump their oil or whatever and go on. When that does occur, and it used to occur with fair regularity, that's been curtailed significantly. And when it does occur, and we become aware of it, we take action, enforcement action through the Forest Practices Act. As far as record keeping, there other than those citations and those records, we don't have ones. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Would your language
include paint that's sprayed on trees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, I hadn't contemplated that. Certainly we do apply paint to trees and mark them for thinning, and I presume that those are hazardous substances. It would be possible, I suppose, to tally up the numbers of cases of tree paint that are purchased and used and that type of thing, but as I read the language right now, it probably would include that, and even with the changes that I suggested, we probably would have to keep track of that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Jim Lockwood, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Jim Lockwood, Government Relations Manager, Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. I don't have anything formal to say. I'm just responding to the piece in here that is section 14, beginning page 12, and continuing on from there about pesticide application in parks. We're obviously concerned about the recreational aspects of that. That's what our business is, and children are often there. So we have a certain concern similar to that already expressed as far as the safety of those folks that are out there. As far as we know, and I didn't realize I was going to testify today because I thought it was invited testimony only, and I didn't know we were going to be invited. But in the little bit of time I've known about this, in talking just in the central office, which isn't the same as checking with everybody out in the field, our sense is that we predominantly use licensed applicators of pesticides and so on. What we would probably need to do is have our own staff go out 48 hours ahead of time and mark some of the areas if they would know exactly where something might be applied, like pesticide spray around the restroom or wherever it was. But we would like to use them to post some of the signs because some of our parks, especially in remote rural areas, can be quite a drive out there for somebody who's licensed to just go stick a sign in the ground and then come back 2 days later to actually apply it. So just minor things like that, but we don't foresee any big problem as far as meeting this, and we certainly agree with the intent of keeping things safer.
Hey, there's a Michael out to a remote restroom to spray or something. Do you have a regular schedule? So like, for example, you had a regular schedule. Expect to have this sprayed on Tuesday the 26th. Little board I put up on there. It would indicate that. Then the person, once they made the application, would then post it with some of the very simple signs, and you notice that they...
Right.
Do you see that being a problem for parks?
Not at this point. Not unless we have some peculiar thing out there that we aren't really thinking about. But, no, it's fairly straightforward stuff. And actually, one thing that's nice about this is one of the rare parts of the law. You can read it and understand it without needing something else. So you think we understand it and can comply.
Mr. Chair, what's your... reason behind the 48-hour prior application? I alert everybody that there's a particular reason when it's coming so they can do a little dance or something like that. In the process.
Is that a while we'll answer the question?
As I recall, it was part of Senator Brown's bill involving the public schools, and asking for this bill. In terms of the public schools, I think it was put in because people don't always come every single day, and they might not see it. And so the idea that perhaps in the previous 2 days they might have a better chance of observing what's going to take place, so that they can make a determination as to whether they want to
have their kids running out there that day or not. For these parks, I think that's negotiable.
Let me ask a question. Right now, under this commercial applicator, do they provide you with a report of what was applied, when, and where? Part of the things you saw that they now are required to report, in other words, we have to report all those data from that first sheet I put
there. Mr. Chair, is to my understanding, yes, they do. And yes, the park does. Yeah.
Do you see? You might check with your one of your or two of your applicators schedule where in fact we need to have 15th and the 30th of the I'm sure there's somebody out there. How in our most remote, how often does a park employee get there?
I can't speak to the most remote because sometimes it's a seasonal difference, and I don't really know how you'd average it out. But typically, we'd have somebody there a couple of times a week going. I really don't think it is. And what I imagine is that some things are on a schedule and some things are not, as far as the different situations involved. Whether it
covered, we had a problem with termites. They're going to notify. You know, cell phone or whatever, pick up the phone. When did you get here? Either on Tuesday, post a sign that says Tuesday we'll be applying.
Yes, and I really, if somebody notices that we have some kind of a problem in some location, we're more likely to be there more often anyway for whatever the reason. I don't. So far, we can't foresee anything that creates any big problem as long as we can post the sign. And since these are straightforward what they are, they're easy to get a hold of, and so you're not some unique, hard to come by sign or something like that, then I just don't see any problem. Especially if this were required. Thank you.
You know, this was not invited testimony until this moment. Okay, I want everybody to know that. Go ahead.
Jan Lee with the Oregon Water Resources Congress.
Jan, the reason we're inviting you up is you asked to come up. So I want that on the record, and in case we have questions about our procedure.
I'm Jan Lee.
635, give me a break. New rules every day. Can't possibly violate them.
Yes, I'm Jan Lee, Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress, and I'm speaking to this bill because irrigation districts, which we represent, use a number of the pesticides which currently would be classified as hazardous substances under this bill. Both subsections A and B of Section 1 refer to pesticides as hazardous substances. And I think changing the definition to display them in that manner will create a number of problems with EPA because EPA classifies a hazardous waste or hazardous substance entirely differently, and we may do some major conflict to state and federal laws as a result of using the words in the way that they're used. Actually, the CIFRA division of EPA classifies some of the pesticides as beneficial use and not hazardous use. Our districts already record storage, report to the fire marshal. We license our folks, the managers, oversee their process. I think that changing from private to commercial would not be a problem. In fact, I think the shift has already occurred.
Sam, could you back up a little bit? Because I'm looking at this, and give me exactly where you are, because if the registration was, the listing was, in fact, beneficial, wouldn't fall into this anyway.
So explain to me where you are right now.
Okay. I'm looking at the definition or the use of hazardous substance.
Are you on dash 4?
I'm on the dash 4 in section 1. There's reference to hazardous substances relating to agriculture.
What line?
I'm looking at line 17 and 18. And then there was another portion of the bill where hazardous substance is redefined to include pesticides. So I'm relating that to that definition, if I could find where it is. But I'm tying my use of those words back to that definition, which was, I thought, fairly early on in the bill.
Page 3, hazardous substance, line 3, item 4.
Right.
Okay, we don't see pesticides.
No, there's another piece of this amendment where there was pesticide, and perhaps as I continue the testimony, I can leaf through here and find it yet. Oh, here it is. It's on page 9 in section 8, lines 7 and 8.
Okay. Pesticide and hazardous substance.
Right. So I'm pointing out the problem that EPA and the state may treat some of these substances differently as a result of expanding that definition.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps the Department of Ag, EPA, and DEQ can work on that further and find the correct way to.
Hey, Bob Albers is coming up from the Fire Marshal.
Hey.
This is not. What about answer this question?
Could you state the question again for me?
Yes, what I was saying is that EPA in their FIFRA division, which deals with insecticides, actually lists some of the pesticides as beneficial use and not hazardous use. Hazardous waste or hazardous chemicals are those that are regulated by RCRA, which is a very much higher level process, as you're probably aware. And I think mixing those definitions in this bill creates some certain problems that maybe the agencies can work out.
Senator George, members of the committee, the first reference that was referred to out of 453.307, the definition that is in there is the definition that's in the Oregon Community Regional Protection Act having to do with our reporting requirements, and that report, within that, the definition of a hazardous substance actually under our program is the broadest umbrella of all hazardous substance reporting. It includes pesticides, toxics, radioactive materials, any substance that the manufacturer of that particular product is required to develop a material safety data sheet is required to falls within that definition. The other reference of a definition that's in here contained later on is actually, it's my understanding, that's actually in ORF 654, which is Department of Ag regulation. So the two, I'm not sure, necessarily correlate. I don't see that this change in here definition impacts the definition that we have, because the proposed change occurs in 654, not 453. And we certainly would hope that it wouldn't change the definition under 453.
Mr. Chair, committee members.
Does your list include things like antibacterial household sprays and that sort of stuff?
Chairman George, Senator Dukes, the definition of a hazardous substance for our reporting requirements is any product the manufacturer is required to develop a material safety data sheet for. If a company has a product like that and they have them present in reportable quantities, they would be required to report those to us. So the specific that you're thinking of, I'm not sure whether or not it would be or not. I'll give you an example that there are certain exemptions from material safety data sheet requirements that are actually regulated by Oregon OSHA. But things like all pesticides are required to have material safety data sheets and are covered by that. Fertilizers, herbicides, rodenticides.
That sounds like a really dumb question, especially with quarters of seven. But Senator George was saying the other day on the floor that a pesticide is something that kills pests. So I am assuming that an antibacterial spray will kill pests.
I mean, I guess I'm wondering, is it, page one talks about homeowners and other individuals may possess hazardous substances for ordinary household uses, and I assume that's what we're talking about. And then it's, he's got a definition, and he's got a definition. I'm a little off.
Chairman George, Senator Deuce, this is one of the challenges that folks have in trying to find hazardous substance information and what's in what. Is the definition from one program to the next program is different. I can give you many, many examples of differences in report in what the definition is. Our definition of a hazardous substance for reporting purposes, to keep in mind, you know, what we're looking for is to target the information of identifying where hazardous substances are. It's the broadest umbrella that you're going to find out there. And those household products that would have herbicides contained within, then pet supplies as an example, would be reportable under our program if present in large enough quantities and in the appropriate setting. But they're not reportable in-house. Our reporting program only covers businesses, employers, owners, and operators of fixed site facilities.
Talking about it again, your question is, if you're using a pest...
FCRA calls them beneficial for certain purposes, such as agriculture purposes, rather than hazardous. If it's registered.
Senator George, members of the committee, I can't speak to what DEQ or the Department of Agriculture will consider a useful pesticide. Our office doesn't have that kind of a definition. We're not looking at usefulness of it, non-usefulness of it. All we're trying to do is identify where is the stuff at, so that those folks that have those kinds of concerns and interests can figure, can find them, and then develop the programs and that they want to around that information.
Yeah, let me ask a question then. Basically right now, your folks who go out to do an application, how do they treat this? Because you're...
Yes, we actually, Mr. Chair, record each application, maintain the records in a log for a number of years. They're open to the public because we're public entities. We actually notice people via the media where we are going to be applying and what schedule. I think where the problem lies for us is because this bill is so broad, it doesn't tell us what we're supposed to do with the 35,000 farmers that use the land within irrigation districts and who may contaminate water in our canals. Are we supposed to have those 35,000 people then report to us? If looking at the bill, I would think that we would really have to be looking at broadly. I'm reading the overall bill and the requirements that it sets. So this bill would apply to farmers and not just the agencies who operate those. This talks about, if this is in the definitions or the findings in section one, that speaks to anyone who uses hazardous substances, and if pesticides are hazardous substances, then one would have to draw the conclusion that all of those farmers in the districts that we report for the delivery of water actually have something to do with the water in the districts. So it would appear that that's the burden because there's no exemption for that.
This is almost like a joint resolution. It's just a statement of... In fact, it sounds like you're already meeting all the conditions of the bill.
So except for subsection D, Mr. Chair, speaks to the escape of hazardous substances into the environment, causing injury to people, fish, animal life, and crops. But what I was going to say, Mr. Chair, is that registered pesticides are allowable for use with people, fish, animals, and are beneficial to crops. And so,
activity to do anything described in that line.
Mm-hmm.
If the farmer did that, he better
stuff up his insurance quick.
Right. What I'm saying, Mr. Chair, is that if you use them according to the label, they do not have this result, and yet this statement is in the law now. So I find great problems with this bill. Oh, I forgot one of my proposed amendments. Come to speak of that. Section 26, subsection 1 on page 19. Everything on this page has a criminal penalty except for subsection 1, and I would suggest that there be a criminal penalty for subsection 1.
Have you read Senate Bill 1010?
Senate Bill 1010, the Agriculture Water Management Quality Plan? Yes.
$10,000 a day, $200,000 maximum fine, 10 years in jail. Okay. Does that now apply to agriculture?
I'm talking about those making false or misleading claims through the media. Referring to Senator Fisher's question.
Question, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Terry Witt, Oregonians for Food and Shelter.
Terry is another one that was not invited to testimony, but who asked to speak to us and achieved a couple of things we may need to modify.
Right. Thank you, Senator George and members of the committee. I'd like to make a number of points. Number one, I think from a general perspective, one has to admit that Senate Bill 1028 sure does level the playing field. OFS as an organization. Oh, sure can. Everybody's getting late. In section 13 and 14, pages 10 and 12, the concern I have, section 13, the way that the bill is currently drafted in a similar fashion on section 15, or 14, excuse me, is I believe the subsection 1 should be after the word shall. The way it is currently drafted, section 1 is the only section that applies specifically in this case to school and child care facilities. And I believe that you wanted all of the, in this case, you wanted all of the other subsections through subsection 7 to apply specifically to school and child care facilities. So that should be drafted, in my understanding, the one should be moved from where it is currently located, a colon be placed after the first shall, and number one be immediately prior to post. That way, subsections 1 through 7 apply to school and child care facilities. The same thing on section 14, a colon should be placed after operation of the park shall, colon, 1, post signs to identify. That way it specifically, all of the subsections specifically modify what a park or public agency must do. Otherwise, they stand alone and say that anyone doing indoor or structural pesticide applications would have to follow these recommendations. And I don't think that's the intent of the legislation. That's one major provision that I do believe needs to be modified. The other is, I think it was alluded to a little bit by the representative from the Forest Service, and that is that typically when there is posting done, it's stated that it is the responsibility of the landowner or the facility owner to post, maintain, and remove. The main problem being obviously an applicator, if it's done by a commercial applicator, is not around to ensure that somebody doesn't take the sign down and ensure that it stays up for the required 24 hours. If they did, as was mentioned, it would be an extremely expensive proposition, and I don't think that's, again, was the intent. So I would recommend that in both those cases, the school section and the park section, that it be clearly stated that there is a responsibility of the facility owner to post, maintain, and remove, even though it may be a contractual agreement with, if they commercially do that. It could be a contractual, but it's ultimately their responsibility. The last comment that I have, just quickly running through, the last comment that I do have is that I would be a little bit concerned with the definition of pesticides as it excludes antimicrobial agents, particularly as it deals with schools. Having knowledge of many of the materials that are used in sanitizing and disinfecting, those materials are innately more toxic than many of the chemicals that are used in school areas and are probably in areas that are likely much more readily available to school children in terms of restrooms and shower facilities and lunchroom facilities. So I would really question whether or not, particularly in the school arena, whether or not you would want to exclude the antimicrobials. I can give you a classic example, a couple compounds that people are very familiar with. Roundup, for instance, which is a herbicide that may be used out in the playground, is considerably less toxic than table salt, or common household bleach, or many other disinfectants that are used inside the school. So I would just note that might be something that you would take a look at before you blanketly exclude antimicrobials if you're trying to make sure that people have notice of some of these materials. Those are the specific comments that I had, Mr. Chair.
Sure, we appreciate that. I just asked Senator Wild, didn't he originally have that in the bill? And I think what happened, I believe that we had complaints of the cost and this sort of thing. But I agree with you. Many of those things, when it comes to absolute toxicity, probably exceed many of the things you might find in that playground.
Right.
And so what we were doing here was yielding to a scream of this is going to cost a lot of money type thing. And so,
Mr. Sheriff, I might add, just to clarify, the last conversation talking about whether pesticides are hazardous substances and so on and so forth, they are always considered a hazardous substance. And if they are in a used condition or if the material container is open, then they are considered to be a hazardous waste at that point in time. So using the state fire marshal's definition, they do look at toxicity. And when you consider things like pecan shells and sand and those kind of things as being hazardous materials, it stands to reason that all pesticides and all disinfectants and soaps would be considered hazardous materials as well.
Yes, you just find all those things listed there. And some of the material safety data sheets are kind of startling to read because you realize that pretty heavy-duty pesticide inside of particularly like the antibacterial soaps.
And some of the paints that even have anti-fouling agents in them do contain pesticides.
Long-term residual agents.
The only way you can really tell on a pesticide is to look to see if it carries an EPA registration, because similar products, based upon their claim, are either considered to be a pesticide or not a pesticide. Bleach is a classic example. Currently, because very few manufacturers put the word kills bacteria on the label, most of them are now not considered a pesticide. I believe Purex is the only one that still uses the term kills bacteria, and it's the only one that I've seen lately that has the EPA registration on. So it's kind of technical. The two products identical, but depending on claim.
Yeah, any helpful amendments would be greatly appreciated. And if you guys would contact Brad, I think he has them down, though. That would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, thank you.
Mike over here. Anything further to come before this committee? I thank you all for your patience. Proceedings have been very beneficial. And with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1028, and we will be adjourned.